Thank you very much. If you look through the proceedings and read the paper, I've actually got four different case studies. This is a short talk today, so I'm only going to have a chance to cover one of those. And in fact, I think I'm only going to spend two slides talking about the recovery. I want to spend a bit more time talking about the issues that are raised as part of recovering an old piece of software and trying to bring it back to life. But I have to start with a warning. There's no science content in this talk, unfortunately. So there's no experimental results, there's no conclusion, there's no future work. Well, there probably is a lot of future work. And for those people who watch Mythbusters, I've stolen the slide, I hope you don't mind. But what I want to try and do is to drive home a message to you that history is important. What you're doing at the moment is fine, but the programs you write today, the programs you run today, the systems you build today, in 5 years' time, they're going to be rusty. In 10 years' time, they're going to be decrepit. And if you can still get them to run in 20 years' time, you're doing a damn good job. But at the same time, everything you do today is going to become a thread that forms the fabric of future history. So in 100 years' time, people are going to say, what were they doing with computers at the beginning of the 21st century? And everything you're doing in this room today and this week and in the next year is going to be part of that history. If we don't worry about capturing what we're doing now, then people are not going to be able to understand what it was that we were doing later on. And I also want to wish happy birthday to Unix. Unix turns 40 this year. In August, 40 years ago, Ken Thompson sat down and started to write what would become the Unix operating system. It's also the 35th birthday for Usenix as well. So originally called the Unix Users Group, but they had to change their title because of legal reasons. So happy birthday to Usenix as well. There are not many pieces of software who can celebrate their 40th birthday and claim to still be, in some regards, relevant. Now, I know for the Linux users out there, you might say, Unix isn't that relevant anymore. I've got a slide right at the end that might convince you otherwise. Okay? But Unix has never really been a product. Unix has never really been a release. Unix has never really been a piece of software or the source code. Unix has always been about the community that lives around it and drives it forward and helps out and contributes. And that same community is what we now see in the open source projects. So happy 40th birthday, effectively community-driven programming as well. Okay, so I want to talk about what it's like to try and restore a computing artifact. And what do I mean by an artifact? It could either be a piece of hardware or it could be a piece of software. I'm going to concentrate mainly on the software side of things. And of course, there are other things that we can use to do the restoration, and they themselves are also artifacts worth considering. The documentation, blueprints, schematics, config files, even down to getting oral anecdotes. So you ring up someone and say, hey, what was it like to use XYZ? Oh, well, you had to remember to do this before you did that. Things like this help you do an effective job at restoration. And everything I'm just about to show you are things that I've had to deal with as part of doing some of the Unix restoration work. First up, what if the artifact's purpose is unknown? Okay, hands up, who can tell me what this is? Okay, what is it? It's this evening's lecture. I actually put this slide in well before I found out the talk that's going to be on tonight. So for those of you who don't know this, this is the Antikythera device, which was found something like about 100 years ago by a diver. And for many decades, people couldn't really work out what it was. But they've done X-ray analysis, lots of other different types of analysis, and later on we'll get a talk about how they were able to re-engineer this device to tell you what it actually does. Okay, what about if the documentation is missing? Who knows what this is? Hands up. What is it? Do you know how to use it?
Nope.
Why not? Because you don't have the documentation. Okay, this is an astrolabe used to help work out where you are, what planets are where they're going to be, and that sort of thing. But sure, I don't know how to drive it. If I'd put you up a picture of a slide rule, how many people would know how to drive a slide rule? Okay, slightly more. How many people don't know how to use a slide rule? I'm sure it's not that difficult, but I don't have the documentation. What about if the documentation is incomplete? Okay, so you know where most of the words are, that's good, but some of the bits are missing. Okay, so if the documentation is incomplete, it is an obstacle in your road to successfully doing what you're trying to do. maybe the thing that you're trying to resurrect is a blueprint, and you're trying to rebuild the actual entity which the blueprint refers to. Now, if it's, we're talking about hardware, we're talking about schematics, design notes, things like that, obviously you then need to rebuild the circuit. If it's a piece of software, what's the blueprint for a piece of software? Hands up. Source code. Whether it's in a high-level language or assembly language, you need to convert that source code back into the original bits so that you can execute the original bits. Unless you've got a C interpreter, it's very hard to run a C program without compiling it. Do we have the tools to rebuild it? Okay, so you've got the blueprints, you know exactly how it works, you've got all of the documentation, and it turns out to be a valve device. Oh, sorry, in here we say tubes, don't we? That's right. So it's tubes. Okay, this is Colossus, and they rebuilt Colossus successfully. But then again, if the tubes that make up the bulk of Colossus are hard to get, you might have to go and build a device to build tubes. So you might have to build some other things in order to complete your resurrection. Now, if you're restoring a piece of software, you might have to rebuild a compiler in order to recompile the source code back down to executable format. So it's an end stage process. Maybe we have to replace parts of the artifact. Okay, this guy's got a serious job ahead of him, trying to fix his car up. If you've got an incomplete artifact, when you try and restore it, and you have to replace some of the parts, that obviously affects the purity. So what you now end up with is a hybrid device, which is part original and part recreated. That's okay, as long as you make sure that you identify which parts are the original, which parts are new. At least with software, you can keep the original bits separate, you can copy them, you can augment them, and still preserve the pristine quality of the original artifact. And maybe we have to make some changes to the gadget in order to get it to work in the current environment. If we try to take this phone and plug it into the current phone system, we're going to have a lot of trouble. Okay, I'm sure it doesn't speak ISDN. But even if we just want to make it work on the analog system, there's going to be a fair bit of interfacing involved, and we might have to change the electrical characteristics of this device in order to get it to work today. Now, any artifact that you restore is going to have to be powered up with current power, is going to have to be connected to current terminals, and so therefore there's an interface issue that you may have to deal with both on your side and, of course, on the artifact side as well. Okay. I want to talk mainly about software, because that's what I've been concerned with. Unlike physical hardware, which definitely rusts and decays and capacitors go bung and that sort of thing, software doesn't decay, at least not while you've got a pristine copy of the zeros and ones. But of course, we all know that software exhibits what we tend to call bit rot. Now, if software doesn't actually decay, what causes this bit rot? It's not a function of the software. It's actually a function of the software's environment. Software stays constant, environment changes over time, all of a sudden there becomes a mismatch between the two, and the software starts to fail or change its behavior, and eventually over a long period of time, the software fails to work at all. Okay, so bit rot is a function of keeping the environment in sync with the software. If they get out of sync, then the software begins to exhibit interesting behavior. Okay, let's get on to what I've been actually doing, which is restoring artifacts from the Unix world. I'm a founding member of the Unix Heritage Society, a very grandiose name for a bunch of old farts in the mailing list. Okay, and there's hands up who are some of the old farts on the mailing list. Thank you, Norman. There's only one of us here, two of us here, that's no good. I'm a very young old fart, by the way. Okay, but I'm getting there. I'm trying to get this to go as grey as possible. Okay, now our aim with the Unix world is to try and preserve the artifacts of Unix, the knowledge of Unix, and try to go back as far as possible to keep it there, because once you lose an artifact, it's gone. Okay, how many people have played, or how many people have heard about the game Space War? Hands up. Okay, that's a fair number. How many people have seen it in action? How many people have played it? Okay, for those of you who haven't played it, how do you know about it? Obviously, someone has told you about this artifact, but you've never experienced it. So therefore, who has the right to tell you that Space War is an interesting artifact? you've had second or third-hand knowledge about its importance. You have never had the chance to sit down and say, hey, this is a really cool game to play. I really enjoyed it. And it was written so many decades ago. That's quite incredible. So once we start losing history, all we get is hearsay and anecdote and newspaper articles, or maybe we should say blog articles these days, about what it was like to be there. But of course, everything that gets fed through human beings gets distorted, we get things filtered out, we lose information. If we can keep the original artifacts, then at least historians in the future can make their own decisions as to what was the worth of this artifact, and also fit it back into the context of the time. Now, we try to keep old systems working. And a lot of those systems have been quite easy. So things like 7th edition Unix from 1979, 6th edition Unix from 1976, a lot of those were still in existence, bootable disk images, tape images. So they're all ready in a state where we can actually put them on computers or put them on simulated computers, get them up. That was quite easy. As we go further and further back, it gets harder and harder to restore and to get artifacts working again. So some of the successes which are documented in the paper, restoration of the first version of Unix written in the C language. Okay, so you've got to remember that before 1973, Unix was written in PDP 11 assembly language. And then, of course, they decided that it would be good to make it portable, write it into a higher level language, although some might argue that C is just a glorified assembler. So they moved it into C, and we were able to get that version up and running again. So read the paper if you want to know how that happened. Of course, C is itself an interesting language, an interesting artifact, and Dennis Ritchie was able to find the earliest versions of the C compiler. And he sent them in my direction, and Dennis is always interesting. He sends me things and he says, gee, I bet no one would ever be able to get this to run again. Or words to that effect, which of course to me is like waving a big red flag saying, all right, let's go and have a fun trying to make it work. And of course, if you think about the earliest versions of C, the language itself was in a great state of flux. So the compiler could compile itself, then they would add things that would break the compiler, and so then they would have to retrofit things to make the compiler compile the next version of the compiler. And so the earliest versions couldn't even be compiled by compilers 2 years later. So resurrecting the earliest version of the compiler was very interesting. And then we found some early binaries written back in 1972, second edition Unix. Of course, we didn't have a Unix operating system, so I was able to resurrect, effectively, how many people know the Wine system to run Windows binaries? Okay, so I effectively wrote a PDP-11 simulator to implement user mode programs. The great holy grail, though, was the first edition of Unix, which, as far as we all knew, had been lost to history. No one could find anything but maybe a few half pages of snippets of code written on paper. Now, what did you get if you could run Unix first edition way back in 1971? Well, you had a standard hierarchical file system, files, directories, subdirectories. You had preemptive multitasking. And, of course, you had processes with process address spaces. They couldn't interfere with each other. Now, by the way, this was only 10 to 12 years after time sharing had been invented. So this is fairly significant that we had this only after 10 years that the concept of multitasking had been invented. Of course, we had a shell. We had multiple users at the same time on the same computer. How many people running Vista can have multiple users on the same machine at the same time? Okay, including email. Of course, we had mountable storage, so that instead of having drive letters, we had a single file system concept. And we had hard links. And of course, Unix was designed for developers, so we had multiple languages, including assembly, Fortran, BASIC, shell scripting, and a language called TMG, which disappeared. Oh, and by the way, picture. Dennis is the one with the beard, strangely enough, and Ken sitting down is the one without the beard. They swapped the beards over at a later point. Okay. Not sure if that was a compatibility issue or what. And then 3 or 4 years ago, Al Cosso from the Computer History Museum unearthed a paper listing of first edition Unix. This is just the front page. Okay, here it is. It's on paper. It's actually got the instructions and some comments. Now, interestingly, these comments were put in by another person. They weren't there originally. So you've got this artifact on paper. And my first reaction was, my God, here it is. And my second reaction is, wow, we can get it to run again. And my third reaction is, how the hell are we going to do that? Because it's not going to be easy. We need to scan it in. We need to make sure that any scanning mistakes fixed. And by the way, after reading through it, you find that instruction does something, the comment says something else, and in the margin there's some handwritten comments that say a third thing. Okay, which one of those do you believe? It's in assembly code, and of course it's in an early version of the assembly that they had, so we need a first edition assembler, which of course doesn't exist anymore. There's no bootstrap code, so we can't boot it. I don't have a PDP 1120 lying around in my basement. Maybe some people here do. Norman, no, you don't have. So we need a simulator. But of course, we need to augment it to simulate all of the peripherals that we need. And of course, we need not just the operating system, but we need executables. You can't boot up an operating system if you can't type ls and cp and mv and that sort of thing. And we do have some binaries from 18 months later. But we're talking the earliest part of the development phase, so things are moving quite rapidly. Maybe yes, maybe no, that these things are going to be able to work. So what did we do? After a couple of years of indecision, Tim Newsham said to me, hey, let's just get it done. Okay, so we got a bunch of people together, we scanned it all in, we cross-checked it manually. We took the 7th edition assembler, and we worked out that we could assemble the source code, but then we had to fiddle around with the output. So we had to massage the output along the way to get it to be in the format that was required for 1st edition. We used a tool, my user mode emulation tool, to run the assembler without actually having the actual system in place. We found quite interesting logic errors, missing instructions, other interesting things. It was obvious that this was like a John Lyons thing, where the source code had been taken, had been re-prepared by someone as part of understanding what the system was doing. And in that process, bits and pieces of things had been lost along the way. The interesting thing was that we got it to the point where it would just hang. And what happened was, back in the early days, the 1120 needed to have a math coprocessor, effectively, and the simulator didn't simulate this. So we had to go back and re-implement this coprocessor. And we got the kernel up to the point where it hung. We found that we had a missing instruction. We had a decrement missing out of a loop, and so that's why it would hang. So we fixed that, and then we found out, well, we already knew, that in fact early Unix was in two stages. There was a cold Unix whose job was to scribble on the file system, build it, install init and a shell, and nothing else. So it was effectively bootstrapping itself. Then when you had the file system prepared, you could put other stuff on it, and then you could boot up under warm. So we got the cold working, we verified the file system, we got up to the warm stage, we could log in. But of course, when you log in and there's no executables, ls minus l doesn't work, echo wasn't built in, so echo star doesn't work. Very pointless exercise if you can boot the kernel, but nothing actually happens. So I sat down to write a file system creation tool that would not just build, but also populate file system from first edition, took the binaries that we had from 18 months later, installed them, crossed our fingers, hey presto, we actually had a working first edition system. Now, I don't have time to show it to you right now. If you want to have a look at it, come to the BOF at 8 p.m. tonight, and I'm sure I'll be able to give you a chance to have a look. We then found we had some other bugs, getting multiple users running, but we fixed those. And we also extended the kernel to support the memory space needed for the C compiler, so we actually were able to natively recompile the C compiler on first edition Unix. Quite impressive given that we had to rebuild so much from scratch and also work through things. But my message is, for you today, think about what you've got to do in the future to make sure that what you're doing today is going to be preserved for the future. Here are a whole bunch of things that we had to do. We had to build tools, we had to follow documentation, we had to build simulators to simulate systems. So if I can get you to take any message home, I want you to remember to document what you're doing now. Make sure that you keep your software up to date so that as new platforms come, you migrate your software upwards. If you can't do that, then start thinking about generating simulators so that at least you can keep that environment going even though the future is moving forwards. And of course, Moore's Law helps here that you can write simulators to simulate old hardware. Writing a 386 simulator is quite easy because we've got much faster machines to do it. All software requires an environment. You take one crucial component away from that environment and your software is going to stop working. Now, that includes the hardware, compilation tools, even down to the missing config file. You take a crucial config file away and save everything else on tape or disk or CD-ROM, and in 10 years' time, that software can't be used again. And of course, the system complexity increases, the work needed to resurrect it increases as well, which is going to make the job of restoration in the future much, much tougher. Okay, that's it, question time. Now, just before I take questions, I just want to show you, I said that, is Unix still relevant today? Here's a list of the first 28 system calls in first edition Unix. There was 35. Just showing you the first 28. Oh, and by the way, here are the first 28 system calls in the current version of the Linux kernel. See any similarities? Okay, questions?
I have one question. So in this exercise, did you discover any bugs in the original Unix system?
That's quite an interesting comment. A couple of years ago, when we were doing version 7, it was already working, so that wasn't much of an issue. But a few people sat down and wrote some cert advisories because they'd found root compromises in the mail subsystem of version 7. So, yeah, there are certainly lots of bugs. A lot of them are obscured because 99% of the time, the system works okay. And of course, we're not running this production anymore. So if it ran for 5 weeks and you were hammering on it, you would probably find the bugs a lot more easily. Generally speaking, we bring a system up, play with it for half an hour and shut it down again. So we don't have a great deal of time to find the bugs, to exhibit the bugs and their behavior.
What are you going to do so that what you've done now is preserved and is still available in 10 years or 50 years or 100 years or whatever?
Okay, the first thing, document, of course. Everything we do as part of restoration, we try and document along the way. I've got a Unix archive, and what I try to do is distribute it to as many people as I can get out, so either on DVD or over the network, so that the bits are at least replicated, so that even if I get hit by a car or whatever, someone at least can take the bits and move forward. The issue with Unix, of course, is that up to the 80s, it's fine. After that, we hit the commercial variants, and they're much harder to capture. I've actually got a hidden archive of stuff that people have donated, but of course, legally, I can't do anything with it. I'm not even allowed to have it. And legally, I can't ship it out to someone else to at least have an off-site archive of that material. So anyone who can help break the legal nightmare, I'd love to hear from them.
So unfortunately, because things are short, I'm going to cut off the questions here. So I encourage you to come to the BOF and find out more about this. And I was also wanted to observe that Unix is 40 years old today. 40 years from now is the year 2050, just to put that into perspective. It seems like a long time in the future, but it's not really. Mm.